All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and can you hear what's going on? Yes, supposedly, possible. All right, let me turn that light down. All right, so we're, March 28th, and practicum starts this week for practicum 3. Which means then that next week you have your third lecture exam, right? So a week from today is your third lecture exam, including endocrinology. And don't forget, the study guide for endocrinology is under the tab on the left-hand side, documents. And then you have exam 3 study guide, and right below that is exam 3 study guide for the endocrine chapter, which I think is chapter 17. So your figures are right there, reading assignments and all that kind of stuff. Okay. And also, I do want to make an announcement. I said that we're going to do eyeball dissection this week. And I think we're just going to go over the eye anatomy on models and then do an eyeball dissection starting next week. So you don't have to bring all your dissection materials, gloves and boots and eye protection to lab this week. All right, but next week you'll have to do that for the eyeball dissection. And we'll probably do a brain dissection next week as well. Okay? All right, so this week in lab, you just have the practicum, and then we're going to look over some models of the ear, the eye, and brain. Okay. All right, so we were talking about central nervous system last time. What the heck is the central nervous system? Where do you find central nervous system? Yeah, you find it in the cranium because the brain is part of it, and what else is part of it? The spinal cord, yeah, which is in the vertebral column. All right, and then also we were talking about different kinds of matter, gray matter and white matter in the central nervous system. What is gray matter? How do you think of gray matter? It's a certain part of a neuron, but also because it's lacking a certain kind of chemical compound. Gray matter does not have myelin, so what parts of a neuron do not have myelin? Is the dendrites and the nerve cell body. Right? And what part of the neuron is that? Is that the sending part or the receiving part? That's the receiving part. Dendrites and cell bodies are the receiving parts of neurons. They process information. And the sending part, what's the sending part of a neuron? That would be the axon. And some locations in your nervous system, axons are myelinated, which makes them look white instead of gray. Right? So myelinated axons sending information long distances is what we call white matter. And so there are areas in the brain that are gray because they're composed of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and other places that are white because they're myelinated axons carrying information long distances. All right, so as a matter of fact, we want to characterize white matter in the cerebrum according to a little bit what its function is, which is also going to be determined by where it's located. Well, let's look at the slide over here on the right-hand side. So this, anybody remember what kind of section is this? What kind of presentation is this? Is this transverse or sagittal or what? It's coronal, very good, a frontal or coronal view, pretty much right in midbrain. And so we can see gray matter right on the cortex of the cerebral hemispheres. So this would be, for instance, like the temporal lobe. Here would be parietal lobe. And then we see some darker areas inside the cerebrum. And these dark areas are what we call the basal nuclei. Your book kind of misnames them. It calls them basal nuclei. I mean basal ganglia, but again, they used to be called basal ganglia for years and years and years until recently a new convention says that if you have a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system, we're going to call it a nucleus and not a ganglia, right? And according to the new convention, where do you find ganglia only? Ganglia are located in the, not central nervous system, but peripheral nervous system. So your book follows an old archaic nomenclature, unfortunately. But when people say basal ganglia, everybody kind of knows what you're talking about. These are important for motor functions. They help, right? These are the things that get damaged in Parkinson's disease. And I think that's what we were talking about last time as we left. Right, so they inhibit muscles so that you have nice fluid motion when you're doing things. Okay, now these other areas that you see, besides the dark areas, this is white matter. So You have white matter. So what are these areas right in here that are white matter? What makes up white matter? Yeah, myelinated axons, right? And myelinated axons in the central nervous system, we call them tracts. Myelinated axons in the peripheral nervous system, we call those things nerves, right? So there's a difference between a nerve and a tract. A tract is found in the central nervous system, either in the brain or the spinal cord, and nerves you find in the peripheral nervous system. And what is shown on this slide right here are a number of dark lines, but these dark lines represent tracts. So these are myelinated axons that are going places. And you can see that there's basically three different ways neurons can go. They can go up and down, that we see right here, from the spinal cord up to the cerebrum, or from the cerebrum down into the spinal cord. Okay, and these are what we call projection fibers. See projection fibers right here? So projection fibers take information from an inferior location to superior, or from a superior location into an inferior location in the CNS. That's a projection fiber. But what other kinds of fibers do you see? How about these right here? It's probably nicely color-coded. Go ahead, tell me what color is that, these little lines. Green. All right, so these green fibers right here, they don't go up and down. How are they going? They're going, yeah, transverse. They're going from right to left. So this is the way that signals or that information on one side of the cerebral hemisphere can cross over and get to the other side. And this structure right here is the corpus callosum, just below the longitudinal fissure. All right, so these are what we call commissural fibers. That's the second kind of tracts. So projection fibers go up and down, commissural fibers go right and left sharing information, and then there's a third kind of tract in the brain. And these don't go up and down, they don't go from the right to the left hemisphere either, but they just go from one gyrus to another on the same side of the brain. And those we call association tracts or association fibers. All right, so those are the three kinds, projection, commissural, and from one gyrus to another, like what's shown right here, okay, then those would be association fibers, right? And they're myelinated axons taking information, sharing information within those different regions of the brain. All right, so there are some examples that I gave you in your notes right here. All right, let's talk about the cerebellum. Where do we find the cerebellum? Do you see it on this slide right here, on this coronal section? It's not directly cut, but here's a little bit of a projection right here. So let's kind of just review. So right at this level would be the foramen magnum. So everything below it is the spinal cord. And then this first bump right here is the medulla oblongata. And then the next bump right here is the pons. All right, so this is all part of the brain stem. All right, and then so the job of the pons is to take signals that are in these projection fibers and pass them to the cerebellum, all right, and then the cerebellum makes some adjustments and passes it back to the spinal cord via the pons right here. So the pons is a relay station for equilibrium messages that the cerebellum is going to process. So the cerebellum is important for coordinating your body, telling what muscles should be contracting at a particular time, which should be relaxing, so that we walk in a nice fluid motion and don't trip over our own feet, right? So there are like a lot of little subroutines for walking and riding and speaking and running and kicking that are contained in the cerebellum that kind of knows how to do all these activities sort of automatically. So there's a lot of learning that takes place in the cerebellum for what? Physical types of activities. All right, so that's the job of the cerebellum. And I suppose we can find another better view of the cerebellum. Where the heck is the cerebellum? I tell you what, here is a nice quiz that you'll have next week. All right, so here is the cerebellum right here, and you can even see white matter and gray matter. All right, what matter is deep in the cerebellum? White, sure, it's white. So these are what, myelinated axons? And just like the cerebrum, the cerebral cortex has gray matter, so does the cerebellum right here. So there's the cerebellum. And there in lab, you're going to learn that there's a connection between the cerebellum and the pons. and it starts with a P. Does anybody know what that connection is? It's like a bridge. It's a major bridge between the cerebellum and the pons. I don't think I talked about it last time, but it's called a peduncle. Yeah, it's a peduncle, okay, which is lateral. And there's also a bridge between the brainstem and the cerebrum. And that's not the cerebellar peduncle, but it contains projection fibers that go through the cerebral peduncle right here. Okay, so those are the two main peduncles that you should be aware of. All right, spinal cord. Where does it begin? Where does the spinal cord begin? Yeah, the foramen magnum, and it goes down to about the level of the second lumbar vertebrae, so it doesn't go all the way down to the bottom of your vertebral column, because it just can't grow as fast as bones do. The central nervous system can't grow quite as fast as bones during development. So here is a pretty good view of the spinal cord, and we see that it starts right here at the foramen magnum and goes down right here, right about the level of L2, and then in this region of the lumbar and sacral region, we just have nerves within the vertebral canal, but not spinal cord per se. The tip, the very tip of the spinal cord is called the conus medullaris. Do you see that it's kind of cone-shaped structure right here? That's the very tip. And then all of these nerves coursing inferiorly through the vertebral canal, we call this the cauda equina. Does anybody know what cauda means?
Tail.
Cauda means tail. And what does equina mean? Or equestrian, having to do with horses. And so quite literally, that just means horse's tail because of all the nerve filaments moving through the vertebral canal right here. All right, but this is indeed spinal cord. And notice that in the lumbar region right here, there is an enlargement. The diameter of the spinal cord is bigger compared to this thoracic region. Notice it's thicker here than here. And then also, all right, in the cervical region, right, there's an enlargement compared to the thoracic region. Can anybody guess what's happening in these areas right here? What other parts of your body do you have about in this region here and in this region here? You have your appendages, right? You have your arms and legs, and it takes a lot more reflex activity to control your arms and legs, so there are many more neurons in this part of the spinal cord for controlling your arms and legs in this area. So that's why we have these, the cervical and lumbar enlargements. Okay, let's look at some more items regarding the spinal cord. Okay, here's just another view of the spinal cord. In between the vertebrae, right, there's an intervertebral foramen, and this is how nerves leave the spinal cord. When it leaves the spinal cord, it becomes part of the peripheral nervous system. So this is where the peripheral nervous system originates. All right, so here is a cross-section of the spinal cord. We see some membranes that surround the spinal cord, and we're going to talk about those next. Okay, now here is a spinous process, and what kind of vertebrae does this look like, just for fun? What it looks like what? A cervical vertebrae, right, because the bifid spinous process and these nice vertebral foramina right here in the transverse processes. Okay, now the spinal cord arrangement is a little bit different than the cerebellum and cerebrum that we were just looking at, because deep inside the spinal cord is the gray matter. But where would you find that in the cerebrum? Where would you find gray matter in the cerebrum? On the outside. And what do we call the outside? The cortex, right? The cortex of any organ is the superficial part, but the more medullary part or deep parts of the spinal cord have nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and then white matter is in the superficial regions of the spinal cord. Now what the heck is white matter again? What's white matter? Myelinated axon, so it's carrying information long distances. Think of it as a wire. And where do these axons go? They go either up to the brain, if it's sensory information, or from the brain down and then out the spinal cord, if it's what a efferent or motor pathway. So in these areas right here, these are what contain tracts, right, or columns, right, and they're in the superficial part of the spinal cord. We also see some nerves here and here. And these nerves, remember, can a neuron carry two-way traffic or just one-way traffic? Is it a one-way street or two-way street for nerve impulses? It's a one-way street, right? A single nerve cell can only carry information from dendrite to cell body and then down an axon to the axon terminus. Okay. Now, these nerves right here carry information only in one direction as well. They're either sensory neurons in there or motor neurons. All right, so by the spinous process, what the heck is this? Is this anterior or posterior?
Posterior,
and the body is anterior or ventral, right? So another name for posterior is dorsal, right? So here's dorsal, here's ventral. So these things that enter the spinal cord are what we call roots. And we only have two. Here is the dorsal root, here is the ventral root. So these are some important things that you have to know, right? Dorsal and ventral. And right here, now we're in the peripheral nervous system, here is a bulge that's filled with nerve cell bodies. And it's going to look gray if we were to look inside of there. So what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies that are in the central nervous system? Okay, in the central nervous system, your book misnames it. They're called the basal ganglia in your book. But what should your book really say? Basal nuclei, right? A bunch of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system is a nucleus. But in the peripheral nervous system, now this is correctly labeled, it's a ganglion, right? And this is where nerve cell bodies from the unipolar neurons are located right here. So this dorsal root right here is 100% sensory. The dorsal root is afferent. The ventral root right here is 100% motor. There are no motor and sensory nerve fibers in these roots right here. It's either one or the other. Okay? So dorsal is sensory, and I guess that's easy to remember because there's an S in sensory, and guess what you have in dorsal? You got an S, right? And there's a T in motor, and what do you have in ventral? Uh-oh. You guys, I don't know, maybe I got to turn the microphone up. Well, there's a T in motor too, right? Okay, so remember, the ventral root is 100% motor fibers, which means which way are signals moving? Right where I have the cursor. They're moving, from central nervous system to peripheral nervous system. They're moving out. What about in the dorsal root right here? Which way are nerve impulses moving? From the periphery into the central nervous system, right? So that's an afferent root. Right, so that's what I want you to know with this diagram right here. Right, so gray matter is what? Located relatively deep. White matter is superficial. And the two ways in and out of the spinal cord, either afferent or efferent, and they're just 100% one way or the other, and those are what we call roots. Okay. Oh, I do want to go back, and I forgot to mention something about that conus medullaris right here. Where is that? Right here. Let's zoom into this region right here. All right, so here's the end of the spinal cord, right around L2, and then we have the caudae equina, but there's also a ligament that goes from the tip of the conus medullaris down to the coccyx right here. It's called the phylum terminale. And that puts a little retraction on the spinal cord so that it doesn't migrate back up to the brain. That's important, right? So because the spinal cord might be able to do that and it could damage all these nerve roots if that were to happen. All right, but there is also another condition, which is the opposite, which can be very dangerous as well. And that is, sometimes the conus medullaris adheres to the coccyx during development. And the phylum terminale doesn't develop. So that means then as somebody is growing, then the spinal cord gets stretched because it can't elongate because it doesn't have the phylum terminale. And as the person grows and stretches the spinal cord, then that destroys the spinal cord. And that's called a tethered cord when that happens, all right? And then hopefully that's diagnosed very early on, and then that adhesion is released, and then the central nervous system can start to develop along normal lines once again after that. So That's some important fact about that phylum terminale right there. Okay? It allows for the growth of the vertebral column without stretching the spinal cord. That's important. All right, some other gross structures of the spinal cord. Okay, let's kind of look at some of these other slides that I have right here. This is good. Okay, remember last time we were talking about the brain. And what's the lobe, the most anterior lobe? Frontal lobe. And what kind of function does the frontal lobe have? If you're going to pick one, it's important for cognition and being able to operate correctly in a social setting, interacting with people, but it has one other very important function. And I told you that it's good to think about the frontal lobe in a way that you think about your car. What was that? The motor. Yeah, what does motor mean? Motor means signals leaving the central nervous system out to your periphery, stimulating effector organs like skeletal muscle for what? Voluntary motion, voluntary movement. So the frontal lobe is important for controlling motor activity, right? That's anterior. What's another name for anterior? That would be ventral. Yeah, okay. And then the more dorsal parts of the brain are for sensory information, right? For vision and things like that. All right, so the architecture of the brain kind of matches the architecture of these roots right here. All right, so what did we say the frontal lobe is for? You could maybe think of it as being like the ventral part of the brain. That is what? Motor. And what about this ventral root right here? It's also motor, right? So those tracks in the spinal cord don't have to switch from dorsal to ventral to get out this ventral root, right? So it matches up really nicely with the lobes of the brain. And what lobes of the brain are sensory, mostly sensory? Are those the dorsal lobes or the ventral lobes? The more dorsal, like the parietal, occipital, right? And indeed, this dorsal root right here is sensory. So again, that kind of matches up really nicely. All right, so there are a number of tracts in the white matter that are either ascending or descending. And generally speaking, that architecture is used in the spinal cord as well. So most of those that are located in this dorsal column right here, sometimes we call that the dorsal funiculus, right? These are for sensory tracts, and these in the lateral and ventral funiculus, these are going to be for motor tracts or descending tracts. Okay, because that follows the architecture of the brain. That's usually the case. There's some exceptions to that rule, but that's usually true. So funiculus is the same thing as a column. And what are in these different funiculi right here? These are tracts that are carrying information up to the brain if it's sensory, or motor tracts carrying information out to the periphery if they're a motor tract. So here we have the ventral funiculus, or you could say column. Here's a lateral funiculus or column, and here's the dorsal funiculus, right? And if you were to guess what the function of these are, you wouldn't be wrong if you were to say these are motor and these are sensory over here. Okay, so those are the columns. Now, if we look at the gray matter right here, it should remind you of a letter of the alphabet. What is that? Kind of looks like an H, right? But I see some little points associated with it, and these little points are what we call horns. They contain nerve cell bodies of neurons. All right, so here is the dorsal horn. Here's a lateral horn. Here's the ventral horn. The dorsal horn has nerve cell bodies for association neurons that just travel within the spinal cord, maybe from here over to the other side of the spinal cord, or from the dorsal horn up to the lateral horn where it synapses on a second neuron. All right, these lateral horns contain nerve cell bodies for your autonomic nervous system. And that's a whole chapter by itself that we'll maybe get to next week or the week after. All right, so these are just locations of nerve cell bodies, and then the axons, right, move out from this gray matter, and when they move out, they become myelinated, and so that gives the spinal cord a little bit of a whitish look to it, and then it will leave and join, okay, this ventral root and leave the vertebral column via this spinal nerve right here. So let's take a look at this. So here is the spinal cord. You can see the gray and white matter. And here is a root. The root is composed of all these little rootlets. These are all motor rootlets. These are all sensory rootlets right here. So a bunch of rootlets join together to form a root. And two roots will join together to form a spinal nerve. Okay. Now, a root is either sensory or motor, but not both. But what about this spinal nerve right here? Where is it getting fibers from? Both the dorsal root and the ventral root. So what would you call the function of this spinal nerve? Is it afferent or is it efferent? Or is it a combination? It's truly a combination. So we say that it is mixed. It has a mixed function. It has both afferent and efferent information in it. But remember, these roots right here are 100% motor or sensory, but not both. Okay. That's pretty important to know. Then we have a little bifurcation. A bifurcation is when something splits into two divisions. All right, so remember, this is dorsal. So is this out toward your belly button or toward your back? That's your back, all right? So here's your spinal cord. Where do you have most of your body compared to your spinal cord? Is most of your body anterior or posterior to your spinal cord? Most of it is anterior, right? There's very little that's actually posterior to it. So here is a branch of nerves that are going to innervate everything that's posterior to your spinal cord. But how much body do you have back there? Not very much. So that's kind of a little nerve. Doesn't have a very big diameter. But this is the one that's going to go and innervate all the anterior parts of your body, or at least anterior to the spinal cord. So look how big it is. All right, so these things are called rami. All right, so this one, since it's going posterior, this is what we call the dorsal ramus. And this one right here is the ventral ramus, innervating everything anterior to the spinal cord. All right, so that's a pretty good description of spinal cord. The other thing that you notice on this diagram right here is that there are a number of membranes that surround the spinal cord. And as a matter of fact, these membranes surround the brain as well. And it protects your central nervous system, also kind of holds it in place. The outermost layer right here is called the dura mater. And this is, you're going to notice this in lab when we start to do a dissection, it's very tough. It's tougher than shoe leather. It's hard to cut. It's impossible, almost impossible to dissect through with a blunt dissection. You need a very sharp instrument to get through there. It's almost like shoe leather, and that's why they named it, guess what dura means? It means tough. It means durable, very durable matter. That's the most superficial layer. Then there's another layer, right, just deep to that, okay, and that's called the arachnoid. My microphone's going in and out. The arachnoid matter, it's not as tough as the dura mater. Right? And then there's even a third layer. And this third layer is right on the surface of the brain and spinal cord, and we call that the pia mater. Right? That's the most delicate layer right there. It's very, very thin, very easily damaged. Okay, underneath the arachnoid, there's a space with fluid. And sometimes that's called the subarachnoid space, and there is cerebrospinal fluid in that region right there. All right, I think I want to show you the next slide. Ooh, maybe not that one. This one, yeah, this is a good space. Okay, good slide to look at. I showed you this one already. Okay, you can see the three layers of the membranes that surround the central nervous system. And the system of membranes right here is what we call the meninges. So the meninges surrounds the brain and spinal cord. And from superficial to deep, what do you got? You got dura mater, arachnoid, and pia mater. And you can see that nice subarachnoid space right here. There are other spaces within the vertebral canal that is actually outside of the dura mater, right? And here you can call this the epidural space. Maybe that's kind of ringing a bell for you right now. Because what is the dura? The dura is part of the meninges, like the dura mater right here. Epidura just means what? Superficial to or on top of the dura mater. And I can see some adipose tissue in there. And this is a spot where you can actually inject some anesthetics. right, into this epidural space, and then it can block nerve impulses from entering or leaving the spinal cord, at least at this one level right here, which is really handy if you want to anesthetize just a limited part of somebody's body without giving them a total general anesthesia, which is what? General anesthesia is rough on the individual, and it can even be fatal if it's not done properly, right? So an epidural is much safer to do than a general anesthesia. Okay. All right, so there's that epidural space. Let's talk a little bit about some of the tracts. And I want you to know two tracts, not a whole lot of tracts, but just two of them, that are in the spinal cord. And let's see. Okay, here is one that I want you to know, the spinal thalamic tract. Here we go, spinal thalamic tract. All right, so tracts are named usually from where the signals originate to where they're going. So if you hear something that's spinal thalamic, it starts in the spinal cord and it takes information to the thalamus. Now, do you see the thalamus anywhere on this slide? Here's a nice coronal section. Here's the thalamus, here and here. So signals are in the spinal cord going to the thalamus. So is that a motor pathway or a sensory pathway? That's sensory, right? So that's a nice afferent pathway. So it's particularly useful for taking pain information to the brain for your perception, right? So that's going to go to the precentral gyrus. The job of the thalamus is to tell those signals exactly where to go on the surface of the brain, so it's a relay station. So let's look in some detail at this tract right here. Notice the name, spinal, and there's an O between spine and thalamus, right? Just like when we combine terms. So always, the first part of the tract, name of the tract is the origin, and then the destination is the second part of the word. All right, so it tells you a lot. All right, so let's zoom in. How many nerves does it take to get from the periphery to the brain? Okay, so here are some sensory nerve endings. Right, for instance, in your hand and in your foot, here's some pain receptors for temperature. Right, and so here is the peripheral process of that pseudo-unipolar neuron. And it's going to enter, how does it enter the spinal cord? What route does it take? The dorsal route. And then here, of course, is the cell body. Do you see the cell body right there, that unipolar neuron? And that's located where? That's in the dorsal root ganglia, right? Because a ganglion is composed of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, so that's where they all accumulate. And then here is the axon terminus, so this is the central process of that unipolar neuron. So this sometimes is what we call a first-order neuron. A first-order takes signals from the periphery into the central nervous system. And then it synapses on this association neuron or interneuron. Right, so this is a second-order neuron, and then it crosses over, and then it starts to ascend the spinal cord, taking signals to the brain. Just like this one, too, it also crosses over from the hand. So here is a tract, here is a sensory tract. This is the lateral spinal thalamic tract for pain. Here's the second order neuron. Now this doesn't go to the cerebral cortex, which is where you have the perception of your reality in the cerebral cortex. All right, where does it stop? It goes all the way up to the thalamus. So the second order neuron stops in the thalamus and then it synapses on a third order neuron. And that third order neuron takes the information to the proper location of the brain. So for instance, this area right here, when this area is receiving impulses from the primary somatosensory cortex or the precentral gyrus, you're going to have sensation on your hands, right? Or if we stimulate this area here, you're going to have some sensation on your foot, right? So depending on what part of the cerebral cortex gets stimulated, you'll appreciate a sensation from a different part of your body. And it's very easy to map the surface of the brain to different parts of the body, which I'll show you in just a second. It's called the homunculus diagram. All right, so here is the spinal thalamic tract, and I think this is an exam figure. All right, and so how many neurons does it take to get from a receptor organ to the cerebral cortex for your perception of that stimulus? It takes three, right? Here's the first order, here's the second order through the spinal cord, and then here's the third order from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex. All right, I also want to show you the corticospinal tract. Now, what can you tell me about the corticospinal tract? Is that sensory or is it motor? Where does it start? Cortex, the cerebral cortex, and it goes to the spinal cord. So if it starts in the brain and it goes to the spinal cord, what kind of tract is that? Is that afferent or efferent? It's efferent or motor. It's a motor tract. So I want you guys to know one of each of these kinds of tracts. All right, so here is a corticospinal tract. Sometimes we call these the pyramidal tracts, but you don't have to know that. I want you to just be familiar with nomenclature, corticospinal tract. So let's look at this diagram right here. So where do you start to control your voluntary motion in your body? What part of your brain is important for controlling skeletal muscle? It's the frontal lobe. As a matter of fact, it's what, that precentral gyrus. So these cells depolarize and send signals down, right, through all this white matter, but that makes sense because here's an axon. What could you tell me about this axon? Is it myelinated or not myelinated? It's myelinated because it's part of the white matter of the brain. Notice it goes right between the thalamus and basal nuclei. It shares information with the basal nuclei. But it goes right through this little area that's just filled with white matter. Sometimes we call that the internal capsule. This area right here that is carrying descending signals to the spinal cord. And then it gets down into the medulla, and look what happens in the medulla. Some of these fibers cross over to other sides of the body. So the medulla has these things that are called pyramids where nerve fibers cross over from the right side of the brain to the left side. Sometimes we call that the decussation of the pyramids where fibers cross over. So decussation means when signals originate from one side of your body but end up on the other side when they decussate over. Just like for vision, for instance, your sense of vision, everything you see with your right visual field doesn't go to the right side of the occipital lobe. It crosses over and goes to the left part of the occipital lobe. So a lot of fibers decussate over, so you should sort of be aware of that. All right, but now you can see that, all right, depending on the level, right, it will synapse directly with a motor neuron, and here you can see the nerve cell bodies in these. Well, what horns are these of the spinal cord? These are the, back over here are the dorsal horns. Here are the ventral horns. So for motor neurons, cell bodies are in the ventral horns, and then here's a motor neuron that leaves the spinal cord via the, what is this right here? Give me the general name for this thing. This is a root. Here's a root, and in particular, which one is it? That's a ventral root, so here's a motor fiber that leads the ventral root into the spinal nerve that makes its way to this muscle, but that's going to cause this muscle to contract. Okay, so this would be the corticospinal tract, right? And starts in the cortex, goes to the spine, so that's a motor pathway, right? And that's pretty easy to appreciate. But the other thing, maybe you should be a little bit aware. Oh, it says right here, internal capsule, right? This is like a big freeway for efferent tracts between the thalamus and the basal nuclei up over here. Okay, I think we've talked about reflexes maybe a little bit already, but I don't think it would hurt to go over it maybe one more time, except I don't have any in this chapter. All right, if we got time at the end of lecture, I'll go back to the previous chapter because there's some other things that I want to look at. But remember, what does a reflex arc always start with? And it's not on this list right here, but it was on the list in the previous chapter. What does a reflex always start with? A stimulus, exactly, a stimulus. And you have to have a receptor for that particular stimulus. And then something that's left off your list on the bottom, what does a reflex arc always end with? Oh, this is a good brain teaser. Starts with a stimulus, and it always ends with a response, right? A stimulus is going to be produced by, or a stimulus will end up with a response, and an effector organ produces a response. So what would be the response of a skeletal muscle? Contraction. Yeah, like if you touch something that's really hot, that would be the stimulus. That's going to be a damaging stimulus to your fingertip. It's going to go through, what, the receptor, then the afferent neuron in the dorsal root, okay? Then through an association neuron down the ventral root, out to a motor neuron, to an effector organ, namely the muscle. That's going to tell the muscle to contract, to withdraw that part of your body from that damaging stimulus. All right, you probably have at least one or two good exam figures on reflex arcs. Okay, meninges. Let's look at another good exam figure. We talked about the meninges that surround the spinal cord, but we also said that the meninges surrounds the brain as well. So here is, right, a nice section of the brain, maybe around the parietal lobe someplace. There's a nice longitudinal fissure, right? So let's zoom into this area. So here we've got some skin. And then here is part of the parietal bone right here. And then what do we have covering every bone? Not necessarily skin, but what covers every bone? The periosteum, right? So here is, oh, it says right here. So here is part of that membrane, the periosteum, that's on the superficial side. But then here's the bone. Then on the deep side here is the periosteum on the inside of the parietal bone, okay? The periosteum joins together with the meningeal division of the dura mater. And remember, the dura mater is what, the most superficial part of the meninges, the toughest one. And now you can see why it's kind of the toughest one, because it's even part of the periosteum right there. Okay, deep to the dura mater is the arachnoid. And the arachnoid is not a really tough membrane, right? But it's right there. And underneath the arachnoid, there is a space that we call the subarachnoid space that's filled with cerebrospinal fluid, which helps float your brain in your cranium. And I don't know, you probably never weighed yourself inside of a pool as opposed to dry land, but could you guess how much you weigh if you were to step on a scale in a pool as opposed to like in your bathroom? Would you weigh more or less? You weigh a lot less. So that fluid helps support the brain. It floats the brain inside your cranium. That's one of the functions of cerebral spinal fluid right here. And then deep to the subarachnoid space, you have the pia mater. Notice that it follows every little curve, right, and fissure and convolution on the surface of the brain. All right, so a convolution. How many parts does a convolution have? How many parts does a convolution have? It's got two parts. What are the two parts called? Okay, the depression is what we call a sulcus, and the ridge, the high part, is what we call a gyrus. So here is a gyrus, and here is a sulcus, and then following a sulcus, we got another gyrus. And then after another gyrus, we got a sulcus, right? And so it forms folds in the brain. Okay, so we have cerebral spinal fluid here. We see that part of the arachnoid actually pokes up through part of the dura mater into this space, which is a sinus. Now, sinuses can contain a lot of different things depending on exactly what sinus it is. Like the paranasal sinuses have air in them and lymphatic tissue. This particular sinus is really a vein. So what do you have in veins? We haven't talked about it, but maybe you have a sense. What do you have in veins? Yeah, just the same kind of stuff almost as what you have in arteries. You have blood in there. But a job of a vein is to take blood from your body back toward the heart. That's what the job of a vein is. So this superior sagittal sinus really is a vein taking blood from the brain back to the heart. Okay? So that's what this sinus does. And this thing right here, a villus or granulation, a arachnoid granulation or villus, is a way for cerebral spinal fluid that's in the subarachnoid space can be put back into the blood so that you don't dehydrate. And that's because cerebral spinal fluid actually is derived from the blood in different parts of the brain. And I'll show you that next. Okay, I'll show you the whole flow pattern. So this is a really nice diagram of the meninges, right? So here's the dura mater, arachnoid and pia mater, and in the subarachnoid space you have cerebrospinal fluid. So this big depression right here separating the cerebral hemispheres is so deep we don't call it a sulcus, we call it a fissure, right? Longitudinal fissure. And notice that the dura mater actually goes down into the longitudinal fissure and it really physically separates the hemispheres from each other electrically and in all different ways. Since you have this big tough membrane right there, we give it a name, we call it the falx cerebri that separates the right and left side of the brain. Does anybody know what that connection is that allows information in one side of the brain to get to the other called? Yeah, it's called the corpus callosum. And what kind of fibers does it have? This is how we started out the lecture. What kind of fibers are moving through the corpus callosum? It goes from right to left, not up down, not from one gyrus to the other, but from one side of the CNS to the other side. Those are what we call commissural tracts, commissural tracts. You don't see it on this slide, but I thought I would mention it. So the falx cerebri only goes down to the corpus callosum and stops so that commissural tracts, okay, can carry information from right to left. All right, so let's talk about the whole, this is actually a good figure too. Maybe you should know something about this one. All right, so here is the falx cerebri right in the longitudinal fissure. All right, there's also a dura mater between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum, which is in this location right here, right in the transverse fissure. And so this part of the dura mater we call the tentorium cerebelli, right? So it's just a tent that covers the cerebellum, part of the dura mater, right? And then underneath it is the falx cerebelli between the lobes of the cerebellum. Okay, and then here you can see venous blood in the superior sagittal sinus being drained into the sigmoid sinus, and that eventually drains into the jugular vein. Okay, and that takes it back to the heart. All right, let's look at cerebrospinal fluid in the brain. Oh, there's something that I didn't talk about yet. Okay. And that is the ventricles of the brain. Okay, where are the ventricles? Ventricles are spaces or holes in the brain. And let's just look at this slide right here. Okay, so again, so here are some spaces inside the brain and they're filled with cerebrospinal fluid, so that gives a little bit of structure to the brain. It helps float the brain a little bit, helps absorb a little trauma if you get hit on the head a little bit. So it does a really nice job. Now these are deep inside the brain, not in the surface, so these are big cavities filled with CSF. These right here, off of midline, remember this is the mid-sagittal line right here, these are what we call the lateral ventricles. So there's a left and right lateral ventricle. I'm not going to ask you to know the different horns. They used to be called the first and second ventricles, but now we just call it lateral ventricles. And right here, right at the level of the thalamus has two different lobes, and what separates the lobes is the third ventricle. It's a very thin ventricle filled with cerebrospinal fluid. But here is some commissural tracts between the right and left part of the thalamus. We call that the interthalamic adhesion. So the right and left thalamus actually can communicate with each other through this commissural pathway right here. All right, so here is just a lateral view of the third ventricle. And notice fluid can move from a lateral ventricle into the third ventricle right here. What do we call a passageway in anatomy? A foramen, right? So here is a foramen connecting the lateral ventricles with the third ventricle, and we call this the interventricular foramen. So fluid actually is derived from plasma in the lateral ventricles. It flows into the third, and even more cerebrospinal fluid is made in the third ventricle. And it moves down into the fourth ventricle right here between the pons and the cerebellum. So it can move from third into the fourth via this little tube, which is called the cerebral aqueduct. So it flows through all of these different chambers and then down into the central canal of the spinal cord, all the way down to the tip of the spinal cord. Remember, that was the conus medullaris. And then it leaves and goes into the subarachnoid space and makes its way all the way back up to the brain where it's resorbed. The parts of the ventricular system that produce cerebrospinal fluid are what we call the choroid plexus. All right, so I think I have this on your list. Yeah, the choroid plexus right here is made up of capillaries and ependymal cells. Remember, that was a kind of neuroglia cell or support cell. And they produce about half a liter of fluid a day. Right? It's on the roof of the ventricle, so about in this location here, and this location in the third ventricle, and about this location in the fourth ventricle, produce cerebrospinal fluid. And you have a total volume of about 100 ml. So it's not a very big space, but it's produced a lot. And you couldn't afford to lose that amount of fluid. So whatever cerebrospinal fluid is produced by the choroid plexus, it should be returned to your bloodstream so that you don't dehydrate. So let's look and see how that happens. All right. So besides protecting the brain mechanically, cerebrospinal fluid also contains oxygen, which is good, some glucose nourishing the brain, vitamins, as well as various electrolytes to maintain proper electrical activity of the brain. That's the job of the cerebrospinal fluid. So let's look at the circulation pattern, which we can see on this diagram right here. This might be a pretty good exam figure. All right, so here's a mid-sagittal section. This is the third ventricle right here. Here's the thalamus, here's hypothalamus, here's that corpus callosum for what kind of fibers go through here? What kind of tracts go through the corpus callosum? Commissural tracts, yeah, commissural tracts, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but do you have the
signage? Yeah, you know, it might be, yeah, here it is. Pass it around. You don't have to find your name. Just sign it and pass it on. I don't have your name on this one. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. All right, so here's the third ventricle. Here are the lateral ventricles, and these dark areas right here represent choroid plexus. What's the job of choroid plexus? To make CSF or cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so from a lateral ventricle, it can move into the third via the interventricular foramen. And from the third ventricle down into the fourth ventricle, how does it get from third to fourth ventricle? Through the cerebral aqueduct. Okay, so here's more choroid plexus in the third ventricle. Here's more choroid plexus in the fourth ventricle. And once CSF is in the fourth ventricle, it can move to the subarachnoid space via the lateral apertures or median apertures. These are just holes in the fourth ventricle, or enter the central canal of the spinal cord. And then here is the subarachnoid space, and you can see CSF moving through the subarachnoid space to this arachnoid villus, which then CSF moves from the subarachnoid space into the sinus, which contains blood, and then it gets recirculated over and over and over again. So that's a little circulation for your central nervous system. So we talked about all of these things. So you should probably know the job of the arachnoid villus. It's for what? Recycling of CSF back into the blood so that you don't dehydrate. So here's an arachnoid villus. Right here and right here. So it's a connection between the subarachnoid space and blood in various parts of the brain. Okay, let me go back to the previous chapter, which is 12. And let's look at some... Let's look at a reflex. All right, I tell you what, since we're in 12, we're here. Remember the different kinds of ependymal cells? And it's best to break down support cells in terms of central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. Here is an astrocyte that you find in the central nervous system. Helps make a blood-brain barrier. And it also takes nutrients directly from the blood to this neuron right here. All right, here is a microglia cell. Anybody remember what the function of a microglial cell or microglial cell is? fights infection. Yeah, immune response, it fights infection. And then here are the ependymal cells that line the cavities in the brain. What do we call the cavities in the brain? Cavities in the brain, we don't call them the meninges. What are the meninges? Meninges are the membranes around the brain, right? But these are what we call ventricles. Spaces inside the brain filled with CSF are called ventricles, and the ependymal cells line each of the ventricles, and in a couple locations, blood capillaries work with the ependymal cells to make cerebrospinal fluid. So these are the cells that make cerebrospinal fluid. What do we call those areas in the brain that make cerebrospinal fluid that are made of capillaries and ependymal cells? That's the choroid plexus in the ventricles. Okay, now the reason why we came here was to look specifically, okay, at reflexes. So here is a reflex. How does a reflex always start? With a stimulus, okay? And in this particular case, it's a noxious stimulus, like the tip of a pin right here poking, deforming the skin, maybe cutting the skin, deforming the skin. So here are some pain receptors. So a reflex starts with a stimulus, and you'll be completely unaware of that stimulus unless you have what? A receptor, right? A photoreceptor for light, or a pain receptor for pain, or temperature receptor for temperature. So here's the receptor. Now how does that information get into the central nervous system? It hops a ride on a nerve. What kind of nerve? A sensory nerve. So here's an afferent nerve. And you even know this, the name of this nerve by its shape. Here's the shape. See the shape right there? What is that? Is that a multipolar, bipolar, or unipolar? This is the unipolar, and there's the cell body and the dorsal root ganglia of the spinal cord. And remember, afferent signals can only enter the spinal cord via the dorsal root. So here it enters the dorsal root, and it synapses on a second neuron. This is what we call an association neuron or interneuron. And it's noteworthy because if you look at this sensory neuron, part of it you see in the periphery and part of it you see in the central nervous system, right? So that's why we call this the central process, and this is the peripheral process of this sensory neuron. But this association neuron, do you see any part of it in the peripheral nervous system? No. Association or interneurons are completely contained within the CNS. No part of them is ever found in the peripheral nervous system. But it passes information on to a motor neuron, which has its cell body right here in the ventral horn. Right? And this is a motor neuron. This is going to be a multipolar neuron. The interneuron is a multipolar neuron as well. And then it's going to send signals out the spinal cord. How does information leave the spinal cord? Two different ways you could think about that. It's going to leave the ventral root right here, but what kind of nerve fiber is it going to take? It's going to take a motor or efferent fiber. So here is a motor neuron leaving the ventral root on the spinal cord, going all the way to this effector organ, which is a skeletal muscle, right? And it's going to contract without you even knowing about it, because reflexes are what? Fast, to protect your body before you even know that it's happening. And then don't forget the seventh thing down here. The first thing is what? Really a stimulus, right? So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The effector is the sixth thing. And what's the seventh thing that should be on this slide right here? What does a skeletal muscle produce? It produces a response, right? So effectors, like this skeletal muscle, always produce a response to protect your body. So this is a nice polysynaptic reflex for protecting your body. Okay, so that's it for today. And some of you might have a practicum coming up. So save a spot for me upstairs. I'll be up there shortly. Hi. Oh, it was nice. Yeah. It was pretty relaxing, yeah.
Oh, I have a question. You just did a tax exam?
Yeah.
Whatever's on the lab, right?
Just in the lab book.
In the lab
The structure's in the lab manual, that's it.
Okay, so like nothing yeah. more, nothing less.
That's right.
All right.
But not everything in your lab manual. So it would be less.
It would be less. So
yes.
It
can only have 50 questions. Okay, see you upstairs.
How strict do you grade the origins and insertions?
Sort of. I don't know, you just have to kind of get a feel for how I grade, but I don't know. You've looked at some practicums before
yeah.
after I graded them.
For the extensor, it asks for the insertion. I only put base of the metacarpals, and it's for 2 through 5.
Oh, I probably wouldn't want to know numbers of metacarpals.
Right.
But you should know that a carpi goes to a wrist or a wrist bone, something like that.
Yeah.
Or a digitorum should go to a phalanx, mm-hmm. something like that. Yeah. Okay, cool. Hi.
For chapter 17,
yes.
the review questions went up to 11, right?
Okay.
So at the end, I checked, and it only goes up to 7.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I was trying to compare the
You're getting
answers.
Gypped out of answers.
Yeah.
Okay, so, oh, I'm sorry for interrupting. What else were you going to say?
Because I was looking at number 2, and there's 12 questions for that. So it goes up to 2, and then it's only going up to, I think, 4 or 5 questions.
Uh-oh. I got to generate a key for you for that. By next week, yeah.
Okay.
I'll make sure I'll do that. You know what? I might need to get a reminder email. So
okay.
send me one
I'll
and just say,
it.
Hey.
Okay.
Just say, remember those questions for chapter 17
oh, yeah.
I showed you?
I don't want to be like looking up the wrong
answers. Oh, yeah. I want you to study the right stuff.
Okay.
Instead of the wrong answers. Okay. You're the first person that told me that. I'm glad you're studying. Oh, now I can see you up there. No. Next time. Yeah, next time. We'll be busy enough.